5 of my first 7 jobs till I was 30, I was fired. I was literally fired 5 of my first 7 jobs. You know, if you like what you do and you're good at what you do, it gets the best out of you and it gets out of the best of people. As you get older, you divest from people because you want to deal with like-minded and the smartest people you can find.
All right. Hey, guys, welcome back to the studio. Today, we have my good friend, Greg Bennett, author, speaker, serial entrepreneur, philanthropist, producer, and a genius in marketing, advertising, and branded content. Welcome to the studio, Greg.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Man, it's such an honor to have you as a guest on the podcast. I'm so humbled to have you as a friend.
It was quite a meeting. I think you should set that up because although it hasn't been long, it seems like we're fast friends for a long time.
Absolutely, yes. I always enjoy talking to you. And, you know, it's been such a pleasure also getting to know you through your book, I Make Caffeine Nervous, which I think that's an amazing title for a book. So yes. Good.
Most around me end up having to take Xanax if they around me too long because I do make them nervous.
I love it.
And it's just pure energy. It's not that I'm taking anything, is just my natural to keep moving.
I get that. I think that's why we connected. So just to give the audience a little bit of context, we met on a first class flight. I was flying out of Detroit, and as were you. I don't remember where I was going, but you were actually in town. You're based in Paris, South Carolina.
I live in Paris Mountain, which is in South Carolina. But I do have culture behind me because, you know, they eat a lot of barbecue down here in South Carolina. I lived between L.A. and New York for 32 years commuting. And then my wife, when we were here on a trip, she goes, well, wouldn't it be nice to live here? It's so nice. And I said, people don't live in South Carolina. You fly over South Carolina. Well, here I am.
Paris, yeah. Mountain. It must be beautiful.
Pretty. I have a whole view of the city and it's relaxing and it's I think I'm making the Bears nervous because there's no one else around.
Yeah. I love it. Well, you were actually in town in the Detroit area accepting an award. You were accepting an award at Lawrence Tech University.
Yeah, I had and it was an interesting story because when they first told me that I had won this award, I rejected it because I told the executive committee that I'm not old enough to have a lifetime achievement award. That's for old people. And I did deny it the first time. And my wife goes, you are old. So I called them back and said, I'll accept it. But it was a lifetime achievement award from the National Entrepreneurs Association based out of Detroit and the loveliest people, sweetest people. And I had a blast. I mean, I had an absolute blast being there. And then I met you, so that was the best part of the trip.
Fantastic. And we talked the whole flight. It was amazing. I loved getting to know you. That was an instant friendship. I love when that happens. You're such a fascinating person, and I love the evolution of the friendship and just getting to know you. And I shared with you, you know, as a teenager back in high school, I was just fascinated by the world of advertising and branding and all of the things, and come to find out as the friendship evolved, and then naturally I purchased your book while we were in flight.
I saw that you bought actually 5 books.
I did. I bought 5 because I already knew that I was going to want to gift it out just from talking to you. I already knew it. So anytime I get I have a fascinating book or I connect with an author, I want to share that book, and I like to gift. So I'm a serial gifter, especially if it's going to enhance somebody's life. So, and I knew just 5 minutes into talking to you that you were going to enhance my life. So you got to pay it forward.
I have to interrupt you for a second, though, because as you know, in my book, I hate talking to people on planes because it's the mandatory, do you live here? Are you going for business? And I hate small talk, and that makes me very nervous. So on planes, usually I put on my beats, and I just listen to music. I zone out, I think. And you sat next to me, and you said hello. And in my mind, I said, I'm not going to say hello back because I don't want to talk to anybody on the plane. But you were just something about you. I said, this guy's different. This guy's like you were very sharp in the couple of things that you said to me. And from that point on, it was like, there's a reason for me being here, and we just hit it off. And I never put my beats on the whole time, and we didn't stop talking until we hugged and got off the plane.
I know. It was so fascinating and such a quick connection. I love it. And then to touch on your book, I mean, getting to know you, I didn't even realize the genius that I was sitting next to, you know. I mean, how deep it goes. In 2000, you founded the brand O, Branded Entertainment. I mean, that's amazing. Talk about your journey, you know, into becoming a founder, a serial entrepreneur. I mean, your list of accolades goes on.
I think in the book, I think what's been most exciting for me is that, or why I became an entrepreneur, I didn't really have a choice. Let's talk about when I graduated college with a degree in a master's degree in communication. I tried to get jobs with, at the time, Hewlett Packard, Texas Instruments, IBM, you know, the usuals. When you get out of college, you say, I'm going to go get a job. And well, I got rejected from every job offer. And I ended up, the first job I got was actually being a GO, a guest organizer at Club Med, and teaching scuba diving. So I was probably one of the smartest scuba dive instructors that ever lived with my master's degree. And once I got into the work world, which was, I hate to say, BSing my way in, because when I went for a job interview, I always thought of myself like I could be a creative writer. I always fancied myself as a writer.
Yeah.
And the guy goes, well, do you think you can handle a job? And I said, of course I can. But the issue was, 5 of my first 7 jobs till I was 30, I was fired. I was literally fired 5 of my first 7 jobs. Not that I wasn't a smart guy. I just couldn't play well in the sandbox with other people.
Yeah.
I didn't like working with peers. I didn't like working with bosses. Right before I was to be married at the age of 30, I was fired 6 weeks before that point. And my wife said, do you still want to get married? I asked her, do you still want to get married?
Yeah.
And she said, you seem like you got a lot of drive and you make me laugh. Let's get married. And I didn't have a choice. I started my own business. After our wedding, our honeymoon, I started my own business in the creative world in a 30 by 50 foot with storage closet. And it went from there.
And you went on to work with some of the biggest names, Greg. It's crazy. I'm just going to read off a couple, but you worked with CBS Television. You developed and produced branded content for hit shows like Oprah, Dr. Phil, Rachel Ray, Entertainment Tonight, Inside Edition, Judge Joe, The Doctors. I mean, right. Among so many other projects, but those are just some of the highlights. And, you know, you've also worked with Apple, Taco Bell. I mean, talk about some of those amazing brands that you've worked with. What was that like?
I think working with amazing brands, you work with amazing people.
Yeah.
Simply because they are amazing brands and they hire really, really smart people. To me, it was always, I felt like I was always getting a paid education. I was getting paid to learn. And that's an important part, I think, of being an entrepreneur, is unless you become a student of your business, and I was in the advertising and marketing business, and really become a student of what you do for a living. As you, what you're doing with your podcast and your work, I notice you're extremely prepared, you're well-versed, you understand not only what you're doing, but what I did. Same thing what I had to do. I had to really learn everything from Apple computers to milk to goat milk to Snickers bar. You have to understand everything about their distribution, about price point, sales point, incentives. Clients love it if you become a student of their business.
Yeah. I mean, CBS, Disney, Pizza Hut, Walmart, M&M's, GMC, BMW, Nestle, Fox, Nike, Miller Beer. I mean, Greg, this is like top tier.
It's cool.
Yeah, it's so amazing. Like, who wouldn't want your career? It's so fun. And then your stories in the book. And I love how you break down your book into essays. It's amazing. And I love the disclaimer in the beginning too. Some of the names have been changed to protect the guilty.
There's a lot of shit went on. And that's really, and why I actually enjoyed the book is, first of all, the books I've been reading in the past, the type is so small that you can't read the damn copy.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and, you know, you get a little older and all of a sudden it's like you really, you know, you need glasses. So what I did was I said, first of all, I'm going to use American typewriter, the font. So it was very creative that I felt as if I was sitting on a typewriter. The font was made bigger, so you don't need glasses to read it. Well, I still do, but for most younger people, they don't. And the fact that it says, as you said, I've read a lot of books in the past where there's just blah, 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 just too much talking. And I wanted this book to be about, if you were fly on the wall, what would have been like to sit in that multi-million dollar pitch? What would have been like to be fired? What would it been like to have success? And that's what the book is about, is how I was able to achieve success through example, through these intimate conversations with clients. And more importantly, not my perspective, but how clients were thinking. And that was a key part of the book. Why do clients think the way they do? And how do you have to react to keep the business, win the business, maintain the business?
Yeah. There was a great story you shared about the governor and the urinal. Great work. Great work has no boundaries. Will you share a little bit of that, a little bit about that story?
It was actually when I was much younger, and I found you had, and by the way, there were no cell phones back then.
Right.
So that's a big difference. You had the telephone. So I worked for the state of Florida, and I was head of their creative department. But I reported literally right to the governor because of the image that the work I was doing portrayed. He had to sign off on the new creative for a certain year that the creative was going to be for. But at the same time, it was a re-election campaign going on for him. So he was very busy. I had the studio set up for the photo shoots. I had the travel arrangements. I had a lot of money invested and time to get this campaign done. And the campaign was, by the way, was called First Impressions Are Forever, So Make Them Florida. Amazing campaign. So I had to see the governor, and he had to sign. So I figured, who knows where the governor is but his security detail. So I went to see Agent Sue, head of the security detail, and we spoke. She didn't know who I was at the time. And so she did check me out, that I did work for the state, that I did report to the governor. And I pleaded with her, please, Agent Sue, I got to see him for 5 minutes. She says, look, he's traveling, but he is going to be in Naples at a campaign event at a speech. Go down there and I'll make sure that you get 5 minutes with him. And so I worked it out with her that I would travel down there. He would give a speech. And on the way out, they always have a restroom for him to wash up, but there's nobody allowed in there. So at the Ritz-Carlton in Naples, as he was leaving, I was in there for a half hour ahead of time, putting up the campaign on the mirrors. I stapled everything up. He walked in. The security knew who I was, so I was in there. Governor walks in. He goes, Greg, what are you doing here? And I said, I need your signature, Governor. So he said, in the restroom? I said, yeah. I walked him down the campaign. He looked at everything. I handed him a gold by cross pen. Signed it, and that was that.
Man, you know how to get the job done, though. And yeah, like you say, great work has no boundaries.
And on the way out, he did smile and said, by the way, you owe Agent Sue a big one on this one because she told me you'd be looking for me.
Yes.
So it was pretty cool. It was a lot of fun. But that's what it takes to get business done.
Yeah, and I love how you touch on just entrepreneurship in your book. And, you know, I don't see you as old as you say you see yourself. And I think that you've got a lot of youthful energy and creativity in you. And I feel like a young old soul myself. So, like, I feel like when I'm chatting with you, I can tap into your energy. And I love, like, it was almost like I was teleporting in your book. It was cool. So it was some of those stories were very exciting. And you go back into kind of, you know, it's different times now. So like you said, back then there were no cell phones. There were no, like, you were doing the work. It was your creative genius that was earning your money. You know,
well, thank you.
You were working for that, and that's, you know, that's a big accomplishment, and you deserve that Lifetime Achievement Award, no matter how young you are.
You know, if you like what you do, and you're good at what you do, as you are, because that's why I'm sitting here, it gets the best out of you, and it gets out of the best of people. But there's something interesting you said about being an entrepreneur and being successful. I think in this world today, the word entrepreneur is thrown around almost as the word consultant was 15 years ago. People that are just starting out, they go, well, I'm an entrepreneur. Or they fix bicycles. I'm an entrepreneur. Well, I do believe there's a big difference between being an entrepreneur. If you look at Steve Jobs, or you look at Elon Musk, or Oprah Winfrey, Sarah Blakely, I do believe those individuals, you're born with a DNA to be an entrepreneur, because the skin is so thick and your spirit of tenacity is so deep that you don't learn that. You're born with that. I was asked one time, I said, well, what about the person that has 4 or 5 Starbucks stores? Aren't they entrepreneurs? Well, no, they're actually small business people, or business people, because what they did is they bought into a franchise. The entrepreneur was the inventor of Starbucks.
Right.
And I think entrepreneur became very sexy with Richard Branson and a lot of people, because they see the life they live and the excitement they live. But they don't realize that they really busted their ass for years, eating dirt, literally getting kicked in the ass every day. And that's what it is to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I related to so much in your book. And so much of it was validating too, because, I mean, I really ate the dirt, or the shit sandwich, like I like to say, as I like to say.
Are you allowed to say that on your podcast?
What's that?
Are you allowed to say shit on your podcast?
Oh yeah, swear as you want.
Let's go.
I got an editor. If it doesn't fly, he can just bleep it out.
Okay. I was just dying to say something. But go
yeah,
ahead.
No, please do. Let it fly, because that's our personality and that's why we connected anyway. Yo, be yourself. I love the stories in the book, and they're so great and so relatable, and just eating the shit sandwich for me for so many years. And then you kind of come up and it's like, and when you network with people that are entrepreneurs, you know, as they identify, it's just different when your journey is that much different, as you explained. You know, I think you kind of detail that beautifully in your book.
I do think entrepreneurs have a sixth sense. And I think if entrepreneurs ran government, which we don't run government because it's too restrictive, it's not an environment for entrepreneurs. But entrepreneurs do have a sixth sense of identifying a problem and finding a different way around it. In government, if there's a mountain, they'll just continue to try to go over the top or build a railroad over the top, and it takes a long time. You know, an entrepreneur would just say, I'm renting a helicopter and I'm going to go over the top. So it's different thinking.
Yeah.
But we do have to have the freedom to work within our space.
Absolutely. Now, and you're kind of, as you got going, as you got rolling, and you worked with all these amazing companies, like we said, Sony and Nestle, Fox, Nike, and you're doing all this branded content, you know, for folks like Oprah and, you know, Dr. Phil. Did you ever feel like you were just constantly going up against competitors that were working against you, that were in your inner circle?
Oh yeah, well, let's back up a little bit. The reason success came early on, although I did bust my ass, I think with any entrepreneur, is the idea of coming up with a better mousetrap, a better idea, a better way of doing something, finding a void. When I started, there was advertising agencies, that was called Above the Line, and below, and media, still within the giant advertising environment. And then you had promotion agency, Below the Line, event agency, below the line, PR, so forth. I might have said PR twice, excuse me. But it was segmented. So a client was really dealing with six or seven clients or agencies. And that's a lot. And I said, this is sort of ridiculous. Why can't I just be a one-stop shop? And, but more importantly, this was the real key. All those agencies that did, they were basically delivering creative, delivering promotion, delivering PR. But at the end of the day, I once had a client tell me, I don't care how you do it. As long as you sell more hamburgers at the end of the day,
yeah,
that's all I care about. Don't care how you do it. So I said, why don't I put in the measurability aspect of marketing where I will work with the retail stores and find out exactly how many cases were sold, how much movement was taken out of the store because of the work that I did.
Yeah.
It was called measurability, accountability. And my God, clients love that. All of a sudden, they know how much money they're making. So that was the, so what I ended up doing was, just imagine the McDonald's project. I was doing the promotional TV advertising for it. I was then doing the in-store sweepstakes or promotion, the game pieces or whatever you were going. I was training the salespeople in the McDonald's stores how to explain the game. We were doing the fulfillment of the game pieces and so forth. We were doing the point of sale for the windows and so forth. And we were working with the stores to actually measure what we did in that store. And what we did was very smart. We were doing tests, for example, we roll out a project in Chicago, but it wouldn't happen in the West Coast. So we were saying, clients, let us do this test idea in three markets, and then let's roll it out regionally, then nationally. Before, it was all just national. I was saying, this is, consumers are not national. The West Coast thinking is much different than the East Coast thinking, than the South to the Northeast. I know that's a long explanation, but what it did was it took a shitload of work on our side, but the client saw that and said, that is value added.
Yeah.
You're thinking way beyond what our agencies think. What's very cool though, then I was getting paid for advertising, media buying, point of sale printing, time in the stores. I was really getting five revenue streams when an ad agency only gets one. That was our meteoric growth.
It's crazy, Greg, and you've pioneered some of the most memorable marketing campaigns over the past 35 years. What are some of your favorite campaigns?
Taco Bell, everyone liked that one.
Oh, yeah? Okay, cool.
And that we were not the agency of record for Taco Bell, but we were known to be very creative. So we ended up getting a lot of the big agencies coming to us and saying, what can we do for our clients? We became vendors to the ad agencies, which I think gets me back to the question you asked, and I didn't mean to gloss over it. But when you were asked about the competing with other agencies,
yeah,
we were always better prepared than they were going to be. We were buttoned up. We had a policy. If we allowed them to ask a question, we failed. We wanted to have every question answered for them.
I love that.
So all they had to do was sign on the dotted line. Going back to Taco Bell. Sorry about that. That's the ADD jumping in.
No, you are good to go, sir. You're talking to the right person.
I don't drink caffeine, but it's like caffeine's kicking my brain.
Yeah.
So they said, what can we do that's really remarkable for Taco Bell? We have a new product called the Chalupa is coming out. And they had already been doing Taco Bell, you know, Ghetto Taco Bell, variations. So we said, why don't we give away something that is tangible, that people will love, and there's the nag factor. Kids are the nag factor. Daddy, mommy, I want to go there.
Yeah.
McDonald's did it for years with their Happy Meal toys. So we came up with a five plush dolls or four plush dolls of the Taco Bell dog. And that became Ghetto Taco Bell.
Yep.
And we worked with the commercials for them, but we did the in-store promotions at the point of sale. We brought the dogs and we designed the dogs. What was very funny about that, I hate to tell you, that was a campaign that didn't do what it's supposed to, because people went in, they bought the Chalupa. The Chalupa sucked. It was terrible. but they went in just for the dog, and people were actually seen throwing the chalupa away and going in just for the dog. And, you know, that's not very different than our client, the Gino. Remember Gino's pizza rolls?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Well, when we were young, we'd eat that shit. I mean, we'd eat it like it was gourmet food.
Yes.
So when we first met the guy, he said, let's just remember, these are for selling. They're not for eating. And that's the guy that makes the damn pizza rolls.
Right, exactly. Oh, my God. That is gold. That's solid gold. I love it. My God. And it's no wonder that you've been recognized within the community by receiving all the prestigious awards you have. Globes, Addies, Emmys, Diamonds, Creative Marketing. What are some of your favorite, like, that meant the most to you to win and be recognized by your peers? Like, do you have anything that stands out in your career?
You know, as you get older, awards mean less.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about that on the plane. And when I got home, my wife said, well, was it exciting? You know, she had gone to award shows, but because she's been on a lot of them, so, or award events. And she says, you don't seem excited about it. And I said, I am excited about it, but you grow up and things have different meanings. I said, well, what did you like best about the trip? And I said, the hotel had the best hamburger I've had in months. I mean, that's really where your brain starts to go, is that?
Yeah.
Become very introspective. I know this is not what people want to hear, that it's supposed to be all exciting. And look, I'm 66 years old now. And I think you start to look at life differently. But to answer your question going in reverse, is the first award I won was big award, was a for Keebler Cookies. It was an APMA Globe Award for the work we did for Keebler. And we were competing against the biggest agencies in the world on that stage. We were going against Shia Day. We were going against Leo Burnett, McCracken Brooks, on. And we won it because it was so damn creative and we sold so many cookies. That was a big award for me. That was validation. And in about, I'm dating myself, but I think it was 2000. Don't quote me on the date. I know it's going back a long time. But I won a Globe Award for International Marketing Professional of the Year. And that was given by your peers as the best creative marketing professional in the world. That meant a lot.
Yeah.
The Addies and so forth, a lot of them are in storage somewhere. I don't keep all the awards anymore.
I get it. I relate to you. This is why we did talk about this on the plane, and I'm into the best burger in town also. And I think that's why I think you're a young soul. I'm an old soul. I think
we do connect.
Yes. 66 is so young still. And, you know, we got talking on a personal level, just, you know, we've talked about all facets of life really. And, you know, as I've gotten along with more experience in life, as I like to say, versus getting older, you know, certain things are less important, you know, and much like you, I did keep a lot of my accolades in a rubber tote, you know, I just kept them in storage or whatever. And then at certain points, I would reflect on, you know, where I had been in life and certain things that I had accomplished. And I started appreciating those things. And I go through appreciation and depreciation with those things at various times. It just depends on how I'm trying to psych myself up during that time frame. But, you know, throughout life, you know, with you and I, when we get talking, like, there's no topic untouched, and we're very pretty raw and unfiltered. And, you know, you talked about kind of just feeling, as time has gone on, a little devalued, you know, just, I think with friendship circles and kind of disconnecting from people in your career as you've moved on, how do you, you know, keep your mindset fresh and sharp?
From my perspective, now this is from my perspective, and it's in the book, and you and I started talking, you shared with me some very, very personal things. And it was like a floodgate of emotions for me to say, I'm going to share it with you. that also in the book, and the fact that, first of all, as you get older, I'm starting to get scared that it's coming to an end, and it is coming to an end. And I'm very nervous about what's going to happen with all my stuff. Yeah. I know it sounds cheap, but this is my stuff. And I know when my father passed away, you throw it away.
Yeah,
his stuff was his stuff. And I'm getting to that age now where my stuff is my stuff and I have no children. So it's scary, but in the book, as we discussed, that I, at the age of 40, I was hit with a mental illness. And it's interesting when you say hit with mental illness, because remember, I'm in the prime of my life at that point too.
Yeah.
And I'm still running this big company and big clients, and mental health, although people talk about it more today, it's still bullshit. No one wants to do anything about it. Now, I'm the first to say about it. No one wants to extend their hand and embrace somebody that is dealing with mental illness. And there's a confusion between mental health and mental illness. Mental health is like taking care of your body as you do. You know, you work out, you eat supplements, or take supplements, excuse me. You're always watching out what's best for your body. That's mental health. Drink water, get lots of sleep, and so forth. Mental illness is when your brain decides to do what it wants and it impacts your life every day. It changes your life. So at 40, I was, as in the book, I was just getting out of the shower and I collapsed. And it turns out it took them 3 months to find out that I had a chemical imbalance in the brain. But severe chemical imbalance in the brain, which was basically an acute panic disorder, acute depression. And I say acute because depression and panic is normal in life. Everyone panics, everyone has depression. But when it totally impacts your life, it's a whole different ballgame. And so I am very open about mental illness. And when you started to talk, I felt like that's another thing as you get older. I don't know if guys notice this at all. As you get older, you divest from people because you want to deal with like-minded and the smartest people you can find. I'm not saying that you discard people that are not politically in your mindset, but you want to find people that will discuss politics with you without walking away, or business without walking away. You want to have real intellectual discussions as you get older. And it does change because the clock is ticking. And yeah. It's also frustrating because I see things that, God, I'd like to do that. Or I wish I did that. And I go, holy shit, I'm 67 years old. I can't start over again.
Greg, I see you. I hear you. I get it. And, you know, everyone's experience is unique to their own. And I think that, like I said before, you are still youthful to me. I mean, just connecting with you and the way that we have banter and your spirit is just amazing. I think you're a light. And, you know, even when you're experiencing darkness, as we all do, and I was open with you about mine too. And I like your point. You know, I've worked in the mental health field for 30 years, and I have worked with various folks with various diagnoses over that 30 years. When I first started in the mental health field, I was working with men that were released from institutions, all diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar. I mean, the list goes on with the diagnosis and the variety of folks that I supported as a direct care specialist throughout those years.
Can I interrupt you too, real quick? I think that's a huge point you made, because mental health has so many compartments that I could not talk about personally about schizophrenia or so forth like that, because I don't experience that.
Right.
As you said, there's so many types of mental illness out there, and one person or a psychiatrist cannot touch them all because they've never experienced them all. But you see them and you can differentiate from them, which is amazing to me that you can help people.
They were my greatest mentors. And to this day, the individuals that I've supported and worked with over the years have all been my greatest mentors, because I learned so much just about their lives and their histories and things that they shared with me.
Were they successful when they were younger? Or are they young now and they're going through this now?
This was the landscape has changed. So my organization, I support a variety of folks. Obviously, in Michigan, all the institutions went away. So we were integrating. This is back when I was like 18 years old. We were integrating folks from the institutions that were closing down into residential communities so they could live a valued life and, you know, not be beaten and abused on a regular basis in these horrible institutions. And that was the life they knew, whether they had a developmental disability or ended up experiencing schizophrenia later in life. Some of the men that I worked with were not much older than me at the time. But like I said, I was 18 years old and some of those men were just 25, you know, and had a series of events that occurred and then ultimately led to the diagnosis. And like one of the gentlemen I supported, I'll never forget it. You know, my very first day at my place of employment, like a white van pulled up and dropped a guy off with two garbage bags and they just took off. And I, you know, picked up his garbage bags, introduced myself, walked him into the house. And I was learning some of his story, and he had a medical history book, and turned out he had been, you know, raped by his priest and molested as a boy by various family members. And he just had suffered just an unfortunate series of events, ultimately leading up to his father passing away. And when he was 25, he just kind of snapped, right? And then he was living on the streets of Detroit and ended up in various shelters and then ultimately an institution. He was institutionalized, and then ultimately that's when, you know, that led me to meet him on the day that I met him. And I worked with him for various years, and for years he didn't even sit down. He didn't sleep. He was the 24-hour man, and he paced on a regular basis. He was on various medications and he paced back and forth. He was always nervous, chain smoking, and it was a beautiful experience developing a relationship with him, though, because the ultimate goal was to help him feel safe. And he always wanted to run away. He always wanted to leave and go back to the streets. So we had to have alarms on the doors and the windows, you know, to indicate if he were to attempt to elope. And I was great at relationship building with most of those folks. And I could always, you know, talk him back into the house, and you know, like,
yeah,
and we would kind of talk it out. And later down the road, I was actually able to connect him with his biological mother, and he had developed a beautiful relationship with his biological mother up until she had passed away. But you know, he eventually, this man, for I don't know how long it was before I actually saw him sit down on a couch, because he paced all the time. And he called himself Starvin' Marvin, the 24-hour man. And he eventually got to a point where he would sit down on the couch and, like, have a conversation with you. Because mostly he would self-talk. He would pace back and forth, self-talk. And he would have a conversation with you, but in between his self-talk and pacing. So he was...
This is scary, because that's what I'm becoming like right now.
Well, me too. We have that in common, Greg. I have my two dogs, and I know you have your dog too. And we talked about that on the phone.
I'm starting to feel like that guy. I'm telling you, I start talking to myself, and I'm always walking around.
Well, I think it's therapeutic. So I started doing it from a therapeutic standpoint, and I started thinking about him from back in the day. Though I was like, oh, I get it. That's funny.
I appreciate the work that you do.
I mean, like I said, these folks were my greatest mentors, and it taught me a lot. I've sat at so many various family tables, you know, throughout the year. Got to learn about a lot of cultures as a young person, and you know, very fascinating. And it educated me a lot on just how to treat people with dignity, respect, and compassion. And you know, when we had a conversation about just feeling devalued, you know, as you kind of go on with in life, you know, that was what a lot of the folks that I had supported over the 30 years I've been in the field, you know, At the end of the day, everybody wants to feel safe, valued, loved, respected, and treated with dignity. And that's it. And I think that that's universal. I think everybody wants that.
Oh, that's Maslow. I mean, look at Maslow's studies. It's always about safety and nurturing. And I do think you nail it on the head. And, you know, I wanted to bring something up that is, over the weeks we talk, and I think you've noticed that I get more and more frustrated, or I question a lot of things. And I don't know if it's, and I think it's because it's just generational. But I found, because of the book, I was never a social media person at all. I've always been pick up the phone or text. You know, when I met you, we hugged. I'm a very interpersonal, you know, I love the feeling of emotion with people. That's what life is about. But I really think more and more people are lonely today, lonelier than you can imagine, even with all the social media. I look at LinkedIn because I have to, because of my, as I said, my book, and I have people who are selling me, we're going to do an SEO search. We can do better SEO. We're life coaches. Life coach, you don't know how much money I have and how successful I am. So they're just out there just spamming. This country's become a world of spam. And that's isolated me a little bit, because it's devalued, I think, my professionalism in what I do. Everyone's in advertising now. Everyone's got a website. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like,
I do, and I can relate, because as a creative person, and I respect your work, because I mean your work speaks for itself. It's
just devalued so that way, because, and I didn't mean to interrupt you, which I do, but I had a guy who was telling me he was writing a book, and I met this guy, oddly enough, in Detroit a long time ago, and he's writing a book, and I know the guy, and he goes, I'm a featured speaker, which I know is bullshit, but he's not a featured speaker, and then his book just came out, and it said, award-winning, what's it called? Award, best-selling book.
Yeah.
He had a best-selling book. And I got, you know, I worked hard for that book to become a bestseller. Amazon, you can look up Amazon, and there I am, Amazon bestseller. I asked him, I said, just for my edification, who was the award from bestseller? And he goes, well, I'm assuming it'll be a bestseller. And stop fucking lying.
Yeah.
This was really getting me pissed off. Everyone doesn't want to do the work and get the accolades. And then they don't want to do the work because you can get rejected when you do work.
Yeah, they want the accolades, don't want to do the work. I get it. And that's why I respect your work so much, because now everyone's using ChatGPT. So people aren't even writing copy. You know what I mean? Like, in the advertising biz, you know, you're writing copy, or you've got the artwork, your whole creative genius is behind it. And now we're watching a generation come up that aren't using their brains, right?
No,
or their creativity. Scary. And everything's kind of fraudulent, it seeming to me. And when you're comparing that to somebody's creative genius with the talent and all of the hard work and the effort, the blood, sweat, and tears that go into building a career like you've built, I think that it's sad, because some of that stuff negates that hard work. You know what I mean?
And it diminishes the blood, sweat, and tears of the work.
Yeah.
And it, you know, I asked my financial advisor, he's a young guy, and he's a brilliant financial guy, but he actually asked AI, where's the best place for me to be engaged when he went to Europe? He asked a machine, where's the best place to get engaged when he's in Italy? The funniest part of the whole thing is, and to me it's funny, she broke off, went with another guy, and kept the ring. So, so why didn't you ask Chat AI or whatever? Is my girlfriend going to dump me and steal the fucking ring? You know, down the road, it can't predict the future. But I always ask people. I say, take a painting you love, take a painting you absolutely love, and look at it, and write down what it is. Does it make you happy? Did you sweat from inspiration? Does your toes tingle because it's so fascinating? And then put it into AI and see what it tells you about the painting.
Right.
No emotion.
Exactly. Everyone's basically using a magic eight ball. Remember the magic eight ball?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You probably did the advertising campaign for it. No, I'm teasing. But no, that's kind of what it seems like, you know? It's like you're just rolling the dice on that. People are just asking, you know, AI, you know, develop this for me, develop that for me, and they're not actually living their lives. True to nature.
And part of life is rejection. And they basically are reducing the risk of rejection every way they can this last couple of generations. But rejection is part of formulating who you are as a human being and using your brain to solve why you were rejected or dealing with it.
Absolutely. It builds character. It's very character building. And, you know, as you know, you get into it in the book and, you know, you eat the sandwich, so to speak, and you know, you take your hits, and that's part of the come up, and not having those experiences I shared with you too. Like during my startup, it was I had the sleeping on an air mattress startup, you know, in my first office, and you know, then my then my, and that was in a, you know, 330 square foot small tiny little office, and but that was huge to me at the time, because when you're coming off your friend's couch, you know, after splitting from your ex, and then, you know, landing on the air mattress in 330 square feet and launching your business, it was a huge space to me. I was just grateful to have it and the air mattress, and then I went, yeah. And then just the curveballs come, you know, the sandwiches are served on a gold platter or a rusty platter, one of the two. And, you know, I had my landlord at the time trying to sue me for $64,000. And then, you know, calling me out for sleeping on the air mattress I can't remember what was written in the lease, but you can't do that. And he caught me one day. Like normally in the morning, I was really good about having the air mattress all like deflated and rolled up, and I'm an early riser, but for some odd reason, that guy came in early, caught the mattress on the floor. I was like,
you look at those are some of the best times, I think, of being an entrepreneur, is you go back and say, I can't believe I did that. That's pretty funny. And I think that's what the book is also, is there's humor in everything that you did looking back. But no matter what the challenge was, we solved it. I figured out a way to do it. And what I love about the book, not only that I wrote it, and it's available on Amazon, by the way, it's if you read the book, it's not one of those, you will become a successful entrepreneur in these 10 steps. Or you will learn how to be a better speaker in 5 steps. Actually, none of that.
I love that.
So read the book and understand the experiences and study what I did and how I did it and how I thought. If you cannot increase your business by 30% across culture, and that's a big part of it, culture of a company, communication and process, you shouldn't be in business. I mean, the book lays it out on how to get business, how to win business. And today, getting business, I find is very hard, because it's such a spam world, and you come up with a great idea, everyone thinks it's just another line of bullshit.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot of what you see anymore anyway. So everyone's selling the same platform. I don't see anything. Like the social media platform is just the same people. I just see this. It's same story, different people. You know what I mean?
Oh my
God. Same sales pitch, different people. And it's like, how can everybody be doing the exact same thing? But I liked your... Right. I like the point that you made about the problem solving too, just about, you know, as you're going through that entrepreneurial journey and the problems come your way and you got to figure out how to solve them and have a thick skin. And, you know, during that course too, like while I had that guy coming for me, the landlord, with the lawsuit, then, you know, I had to sell my car to make payroll. Like I wasn't getting paid. Right. So, like payments were coming in late, and, I had my Mustang at the time, and, I had paid that sucker off, but I had to sell it for Blue Book to make my payroll. And so I sold that, and I walked down from my office to Enterprise and rented a car. I sold that car. I sold that Mustang, and then walked down to Enterprise and rented a car until, you know what I mean? Until I had the means to get back into some wheels.
It's funny because when I had my company originally started out in Atlanta, but it all actually moved to the West Coast. And everybody out there is carfinet. You know, out there it's all show. All show.
Yeah.
I didn't have a lot of money, but I knew I needed a nice car. So I leased, at the time, a 7 Series BMW, which was a stretch for me. But you know what? It worked. And when you go to client, take them to lunch, here's this nice new 7 Series BMW. And I'm just hoping I can make the next payment on it.
Yeah.
And then it went uphill from there, downhill from there, whatever you call it. Success.
I get that too, because in that Mustang, oh my God, I use this analogy all the time for my startup. When I was in the Mustang, everything was kind of going wrong with that Mustang at the time, but it looked beautiful on the outside, right? Because the Mustang bodies rarely changed throughout the course of the years. And during that time, I had it was 7 years old, but it still looked beautiful. Like I said, I paid it off. And it looked great on the inside, great on the outside, but falling apart on the inside. And that's how I described myself during that time. I was like, yeah, because you got to present well, right? Like you're starting a business and you can't tell anybody that you're experiencing the dark times because no one's going to go through the business with you. And you're sleeping on an air mattress, but like eating a sandwich for dinner, which means nothing.
It's an entrepreneur. It's really a psychological game.
Yes.
I mean, it's you against the client. And I was told that, as I say in the book, by a guy named Fred Howard, who was founder of Howard Marlboro, doesn't matter how much you blow to get a client, doesn't matter what you do to get a client, obviously as long as it's legal, but if you don't deliver, you're in trouble. You got to be able to get the client and deliver, or else you're ruined in any business. And we did it. We found ways to win, which were, you know, going to your point, early on when Snickers came to my office in Atlanta, they were expecting a substantial, not a 4-person office. So my wife was working at a place called LeeServe, and the owner loved me. That's actually where I was actually working at. It was the filing room that's in the book, the 30 by 40.
Yeah.
He's the guy that let me borrow his filing room, and, you know, with the one light, the wooden chair.
Yep.
So I said, Joe, I got a problem. Snickers coming in, and if they see I'm only 3 people and I'm the one who has an office in a filing room, they're not going to hire me. So he said, well, what do you want to do? Do you mind if I take your name down off the door and I put Luna Bacardi Group, that was the name of my company, and do you mind if we put cups and everything in the conference room with Luna Bacardi and stationery? No, do it. And Snickers came in, and he had actually some of his staff coming in. Mr. Bennett, you have your 4 o'clock meeting is been changed to 4:30. Oh, okay, thank you. I mean, it was like a whole scene we did. It was right out of Hollywood. But we got Snickers, and we delivered phenomenal for them. And at that time, it was the Snickers race team. Is that we put that together for them, which was very cool.
That's amazing. I love it. That's real stuff. Those are real stories. And that was kind of, you know, my gig too. It was, I couldn't pay myself for a long time when I first started up, because every penny went to insurance policies and then like putting my office together. So I had the smallest office in that building, but I had the nicest office because the building was outdated, but I made that the nicest, in a 3-story building. I had the nicest, I remodeled it all myself. I painted it, got the furniture, set it all up. So I made good with a really nice space, you know, out of what I could. Yes. And, you know, during that time too, like I had to train myself like a warrior because, like you said, it's all psychological and mindset. So with work, you have to use what you have. And so at that time, my mental mindset was my weaponry, right? My arsenal. So it was like, I worked out while I was sleeping on that air mattress. I would get up very early and, you know, I trained and I worked out and I stayed away from everybody and anything that would deter me. And I made sure that I was staying away from anything like alcohol, drugs, anything like that. You know, that I used to partake in back in my heyday. Anything that was going to get me off my entrepreneurial path was cut out of my life. But yeah, that's all I had was my mindset and, you know, keeping focused on my physical and mental well-being was important because it carried me through, and it, you know, definitely helped shape my journey and my businesses as they've evolved. So it's very important.
One of the stories that I shared with you, and it goes to what you're saying about being focused on what you do, is entrepreneurs have a way of changing things. But what scares me about the world today, the non-entrepreneurial world, is that no one's listening. Entrepreneurs have a way, you live in your zone, you live in your world, you can talk to yourself, you can talk through anything, or we're smart enough to find there's someone that can help me. We're not shy. We have no problem asking questions. And where I'm going with this is, we talked about this, I was, when in Detroit, there was a young lady who I had a 40-minute Uber ride, and we were talking about everything from politics to living in Detroit, to family, to race relations in Detroit. And when she let me out of the car, she said, "Greg, I want to thank you." And I said, "You're welcome, but for what?" She goes, "You're the only person that ever asked for my opinion." And I thought, my God, how powerful is that? She's in her 20s and no one's ever asked her opinion. Wow. And it seems though, with this social media world we live in, we're all talking, but no one's asking, "What do you think? How do you feel today? How can I help you?" And you know what? It all goes back to mental illness and mental health. No one is really communicating with each other. If you're depressed, you're not feeling good today. What's going on? Tell me about it. I don't know what you're talking about, but just tell me about it. Share. I don't know. I can't share that feeling, but tell me about it. I want to learn. It's gone.
Yeah. It's called checking in. And I love that we have that too. Like, we have that open door policy about checking in. Yeah. And I know I can call you, you can call me, and that's good. And I think, you know, a lot of, to your point with the social media and things like that, I think it's ego too, you know, like, and it's back to that kind of, everybody wants the accolades, but nobody wants to put in the work. Well, on social media, it's the same. It's kind of like everybody wants you to, you know, the likes and the follows and the comments and the subscriptions and all of this. Everybody wants it, but nobody wants to pay it forward. You know what I mean? Nobody wants to, everybody wants to promote themselves and celebrate themselves, but nobody wants to celebrate others. And it's this, just the reverse for me. So it's like, man, it's tough.
Isolating though, because now you're becoming the minority, not the former majority of interpersonal communication.
Yeah.
Now you are becoming the minority of, and minority could just be mindset. The minority doesn't have to be racial, doesn't have to be political, but just in the way we think and mental health, mental illness. I know I keep going back to it, but it's so important. And I see more and more issues because of social media, of not extending yourself. And it's isolating.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are isolated, and that definitely plays into your mental health. People need to get out. They need to socialize. Humans need connection. Those are the three C's of my first organization: community, connectedness, and companionship. And, you know, that now that I've referenced my organization, that brings me, I didn't want to forget, your nonprofit. Let's talk a little bit about your nonprofit organization. Will you speak on that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's called the Genius Stage. And it comes from when there's always a beginning and a reason why people do things. And so I was on a couple boards, and I was on the board of Florida State University, where I went to school. And what happens on the board is you drink a lot of Coca-Colas while you're sitting there talking about shit, except the football game, and what you're going to do for the next meeting. Although you're already in the meeting, you could meet now. So that drove me crazy. So rather than giving money and my time, I said, I'm going to create my own foundation. While I was working with universities, I found professors are some of the most amazing people in the world, except they're very bad communicators. They just don't know how to express themselves. They really sink themselves into their work. And they have some amazing ideas. They just don't know how to basically take them to market. Well, that's what I did. Between television and movies, I know how to look at a script, write it, or an idea, write the script and make it happen. So I would take their white papers and their research and make a script out of it and put it in English. And then I make short form films, 15 minutes, 7 minutes. So then they could take it to venture capital and private equity firms. And it allows them to get funding for their work. And we work with everything from cancer to dyslexia to gang violence, on and on. My foundation deals with that. My foundation is made up of other entrepreneurs that we look at the problem, and we collaborate with each other, and we say, here's the solution. And then we put it into a short form film. So we have about nine professors we work with. One of the things that we came up with when Russia invaded Ukraine, we read an article and entrepreneurs didn't know how they were going to survive because they're being attacked every day. So I collaborated with my guys, my team, women as well. And we contacted many of these entrepreneurs, and we work with seven strong entrepreneurial companies, everything from candle manufacturers to IT companies. And we basically created servers for them so they wouldn't lose all their materials if they were bombed. We did creative for them. We allowed them to have creative resources because they couldn't meet. They were meeting in bomb shelters. They were talking to our creative people to get presentations ready. More importantly, we're getting them ready for post-Ukraine war when the European markets would open to them because Ukraine's in such bad shape. That is really what the foundation's about, working with smart people and helping them move it forward.
I love it. And it's a beautiful website too.
At no cost. We fund everything.
It's amazing. I want to put your link up. Can you say the link?
Yeah. So it's geniuschange.org.
Amazing. It's a beautiful website. And this is a beautiful book.
Thank you very much.
I can make caffeine nervous. This is such a good book. I want to encourage any listeners to pick this book up on Amazon because it's so good and such a great tool. And it's definitely inspiring. And it's even more inspiring if you get to be Greg's friend and talk to him in person. I can't wait till I get you out here to the studio in person so we can hang out, or I'm coming to Paris Mountain.
There you go. Well, look, thank you for having me. And I think it's great. What I love about what you're doing is you're asking people for their opinion and you listen and you share. And I hope this show will inspire someone to do something really cool for one person or 100,000 people. Just do something cool and listen and help people. That's really what it's about today in our times.
Well, I know that I'm that much cooler just knowing you. So if you, yes, I'm going to continue to read the book so I stay cool.
Thank you so much for your time, and I'll see you soon.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your time. It was an honor having you in the studio. Thank you very much, the amazing Greg Bennett. Pick up his book on Amazon and hit up all Greg's links. We'll put them up at the end of the episode here.
So I'm over here. Thank you so much.
That's a wrap.